And please join me in a word of prayer. Lord of hosts, when you will it, we cannot bar the door against your spirit. We cannot shut our mouths without the rocks crying out loud. Make yourself known in the speaking of these words and the meditations of our hearts, because if you are not here, then nothing else matters. And if you are here, then nothing else matters. O, you are love and strength. Amen. My first question when hearing the gospel passage that's appointed for today was, why now? Why are we hearing this story from the Gospel of John now? This story, which is part of Jesus' final teachings, four chapters that are often called the farewell discourse in the Gospel of John, since they are Jesus' final words to his disciples before he dies. So why are we retelling this story now? Easter was a few weeks ago, after all. Shouldn't the stories we tell and hear about Jesus be about him alive, well, walking, talking, teaching us new things? In these joyful days of Eastertide, on this fifth Sunday of Easter, in this growing, glowing season of spring, why return to a time when the disciples were bewildered, confused, uncertain, and afraid of what was coming next? Why are we retelling this story of Jesus now? These days we have Bibles in every pew and apps on every phone, but it is always worth remembering that in the early days of the church, the only way for most people to share stories from the scriptures would have been to gather with others, probably over a meal, and share the words out loud. It's not hard to imagine these members of the early Johannine community gathering together to eat and drink and tell each other stories about Jesus. Indeed, some scholars speculate that the Gospel of John, more than any of the other Gospels, was always intended to be an instrument of oral learning, a spoken interplay between speaker and audience. The writer of John seems less interested in documenting every fact of an event, and more interested in setting up a dialogue between characters, giving the audience a chance to hear the reflections of Jesus and respond with their own probing, challenging questions. It would have, as one scholar says, the audience would have slipped naturally into some of these secondary roles, such as Nicodemus or Peter, in responding to Jesus' words. As another scholar put it, the Gospel of John is a story that has been given life within an oral culture, an ongoing multi-generational interaction between tellers and audience. So rather than imagining this gospel, or any gospel, but particularly this one, as a series of words written down by a studious, solitary scribe, what if we imagined these scriptures as being reenacted, re-embodied, retold by a whole community? Sharing any story of Jesus would have been a collective enterprise. In the first century, people often gathered in symposiums to share ideas and thoughts. Food and drink would have been present. And as I was reading, this is a fun fact that you might know, but I did not, and it is that the word symposium literally translates as a drinking party, which is a far cry from the dry series of discourses we might imagine. So such symposiums were a common occurrence in society at the time. And in the Gospel of John particularly, almost all of Jesus' oral performances are set on Jewish feast days. Jesus often gathers with his disciples over a meal to talk and share. So, it is not hard to imagine those early disciples in the months, the years after Easter, seeking each other out, finding each other, gathering together to eat and drink and tell stories about Jesus. It's not hard to imagine them preparing a table, setting us into a seat, pouring a drink, passing a plate, turning to each other and saying, What do you remember about what he said? What was that phrase he used when we were in the upper room? What was that commandment he told us? What do you think he meant by that? It's not hard to imagine those disciples talking into the dawning early hours of the morning, finally clearing away the plates, and then looking ahead with eagerness to the next time that they could gather again, ready to retell the story of the Messiah who was with them for a little while, who called them beloved children, and who transformed everything they knew. Here, in the farewell discourse, in the verses from John that we heard, Jesus is leaving his disciples with a series of teachings that they can return to when he is gone. As one scholar writes, throughout his farewell speech, Jesus is trying to communicate that absence does not mean abandonment. Even though Jesus will depart from them, he is not leaving them. Death itself will not kill their connection with Christ. Death itself does not end the glory of God. The resurrection reveals this truth, that God is being glorified now, in the death and in the life of Jesus. Perhaps we too need to be reminded of these words. Perhaps we too can feel bewildered by what feels like the absence of God in our life. Perhaps we, like the disciples, need to hear and learn how to trust in Jesus' presence, even in a time when those promises might seem so distant. As the jubilation of Easter moves into the rearview mirror, as we are still trying to navigate a world filled with virus variants and violence in Ukraine, with mass shootings and personal heartaches and climate change, how do we understand the stories of our faith that we are telling now? We do not return to these scriptures because the verses look good on a motivational poster. We do not return to these stories because they offer us a proof of our own righteousness. We turn and return to these stories of scripture because they tell us the story of our life together, because they are revealing truths to us in every moment about who we are and about where we are going and about who is joining us along the way. As a friend of mine once said, the reason I believe in Easter is because the stories after the resurrection are so weird. If the disciples were trying to prove a point, they would have gotten together and gotten their stories straight. They would have corroborated their accounts and made sure the geography lined up and made sure they had an airtight case. Instead, we get a strange collection of tales. People meeting a living Christ at the tomb, in a locked room, along the road, here and there. Nothing unfolds logically, and yet, in each encounter with the living Christ, no one walks away unchanged. The people who meet the resurrected Christ might not fully understand what has just happened, but they know that nothing will ever be the same again. This new commandment we hear in the Gospel of John is not an easy instruction manual. Instead, it is a life-changing word. This story of love that Jesus commands us is intended to stitch us together when we find ourselves flailing and fraying. It is a story we need to tell and retell, share and repeat and relive every day. Telling the story of God's love teaches us how to love one another, and loving one another teaches us how to tell the story of God's love. And so, week after week, year after year, we return to each other. We gather again around the table and remember what Jesus said, not because we want to prove a point, but because we want to show there is no stronger force in the universe than this love that Jesus reveals to us, a love made known in the glory of God by the power of the Spirit. This love is at our every ending and our every beginning. Our discipleship is not the act of a day, but rather it is the work of love spread out over a lifetime. Last week, I was listening to an audio series called Coming Home to the Cove, a story of family, memory, and stolen land. This series is produced by Emergence Magazine, and it follows the work of Teresa Harlan, who's trying to re-piece together her family's history and their rights to 12 acres of land on a certain cove, which she calls Felix's Cove, in Northern California, along the Point Reyes seashore. Teresa Harlan is part of the Coast Miwok community, an indigenous peoples for whom there is archaeological evidence in the California region dating back tens of thousands of years. Harlan's family, the Felix Sousa family, knows that they have lived in this particular cove for at least four generations, starting in the 1800s. Their family's stories talk about grandparents and great-grandparents who built homes. A few of those buildings still stand, and their small wooden frames are the last remaining dwellings built by indigenous hands in that region. On the audio series, you can hear a few members of the Felix Sousa family sharing their stories, tales about growing up in the area, riding cows, digging for clams, enjoying the land and each other. And then we hear one cousin say, with tears in his voice, "It must have been so beautiful before these people kicked us out." Because in 1952, ranchers came for the family land. Ranch owners wanted those 12 acres for their adjacent dairy business. The Felix family knew that they'd lived there for generations. They could tell story upon story about every nook and cranny of that coastline, but what they couldn't do was produce written documentation. In the 19th century, the state of California had refused to ratify all land treaties with native tribes, had refused to acknowledge all those claims to the land. So the Felix Sousa family couldn't produce tax records or property deeds. And while their stories of the land gave them life and purpose, a sense of meaning and identity, they were deemed worthless by the courts of law. Teresa Harlan's uncle, Uncle Victor Sousa, went to court for 4 years to fight the ranchers. He tried to claim squatters' rights. He tried to prove his family had lived there since at least before 1878, when certain California tax laws went into effect. He pointed to his knowledge of the coast, to the dwelling in which he lived. He lifted up the oral testimony of a great aunt. But the oral testimony was dismissed by the judge as hearsay. And none of it was enough to withstand the forces of profits and politics that pushed against him. And so Victor Sousa lost his court battle, and in 1956, the family was evicted. The cove took on a different name, a bigger house was built, and the family dwellings were then used for rambunctious, drug-fueled artist parties throughout the 1960s. Now thousands of tourists come to the cove each year, and they know nothing about the family who made it their home for centuries. Teresa Harlan has worked hard to gather the stories of her family, to try to find some documentation that will stand up in the court of law. She returns to the cove regularly, and until recently, she says she was worried every time she returned that one day she would show up and find her family home knocked to the ground. She thankfully rests more easily these days because a current director of National Parks has assured her that under his watch, the buildings will not be touched. So now she's gotten to work, and she is collecting stories and building evidence and trying to get the place saved and preserved and given back to her family. She hopes that it might one day be a living cultural center. As I listened to this audio series, I thought about the peoples who've had this same story play out in their lives across history, across the nation, around our world. I thought about the early church, the women and men who kept gathering around the stories of Jesus, around the teachings of their Messiah, around a strange collection of resurrection encounters, all of which would have never stood up in the court of law. Theirs was a community that persisted through persecution and travails, who faced the trauma of losing their leader, and then who faced the despair of losing the temple, a centerpiece of faith in the region for generations. The very early church was a community in the process of being displaced, a people being told that they no longer belonged to their land, their religion, their region. They were deemed disposable by the Roman rule of the day. Similarly, over the course of this series, we too get a glimpse of the Felix family's fortitude, and particularly Teresa Harlan's strength in the face of so much disillusionment. Harlan says she often reflects on, why are Native people able to be so resilient? Why are Native people able to persevere against everything that is trying to eradicate their existence and diminish them as survivors? In response, she says, it's because all these forces are not a match for the love that Native people had and have for their families, for their culture, for their beliefs. The forces of politics are not a match for the power and strength of that love. She continues, this is the driving force for me. This is why I'm working to try to save our family home, trying to get it recognized for the history of our family to persevere. It's why I'm venturing out to family members I don't know, why I'm making connections with people who have an interest in the seashore. It's this undeniable force in front of me, this love. It's an amazing force. Why tell this story now? Because Harlan has started her work equipped with not much more than her stories and her love. Because 2,000 years ago, the disciples set forth to form a church equipped at that point with not much more than their stories of Jesus and their command to love. Because sometimes the only thing we have that helps us make it through the day is a story that we want to share with others. And sometimes, by the force of a love that is more powerful than anything else in the universe, sometimes that is enough. May it be so for Teresa Harlan and her community. May it be so for us.